Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this litigation update on recent challenges to the new Title IX regulations. Our speaker today is Donald Dougherty. Don is Senior Counsel for Litigation at the Defense of Freedom Institute for Policy Studies. He previously served as a senior counsel at the Institute for Free Speech and the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Before that, he was a partner at three of Wisconsin's largest firms with nearly 30 years of trial and appellate litigation experience. If you'd like to learn more about today's speaker, his full bio can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speaker gives his presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will try to get to as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speaker, not the Federalist Society. With that, Don, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Carolyn. Appreciate it. Good morning. My name is Don Dougherty. I'm Senior Litigation Counsel for the Defense of Freedom Institute, and I appreciate you all joining me this morning. Today, I'd like to give a brief overview of the lawsuits that are challenging the new Title IX regulations. Those regulations were issued this past April. I plan on talking for about 30 minutes or so, and after that, we'll open it up to questions or comments from you all. So, on April 29th, the Department of Education published a 423-page final rule in the Federal Register amending its Title IX regulations. Title IX is a federal statute prohibiting sex-based discrimination in federally funded education programs and activities, although that statute has certain significant exceptions, allowing for differential treatment based on biological sex, such as having separate living quarters. Most notably and most perhaps infamously in the news is that these new Title IX rules redefine, in our estimation, but according to the federal government, they merely clarify the statute so that it now includes a prohibition on gender identity discrimination. The Department of Education asserts that the new rule is consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in 2020 in Bostock v. Clayton County. Bostock held that the prohibition in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 on employment discrimination because of any individual's sex included firing an employee merely for being gay or transgender because, under Title VII's text, biological sex plays a necessary and undisguisable role in the decision to terminate. Bostock, as I said, a 2020 decision written by Judge Neil Gorsuch. It was 6-3. The dissenters were Alito, Thomas, and Kavanaugh. On the day as President Biden was inaugurated in January of 2021, he directed all federal agencies to revise their rules and policies to reflect the Supreme Court's decision and its reasoning in Bostock. For the Education Department, this inaugural directive culminated in the April publication of the new Title IX rule. At bottom, most of the government's justification for the new rule, or rules, I'll use that sort of, it's a whole bunch of rules, as I said, 423 pages of stuff. So I'll sometimes refer it to plural and sometimes singular. But in any event, most of the government's justification for these new regulations hangs almost entirely on its reading, or I think misreading, of Bostock. In my opinion, you can't extricate Bostock's holding from the Title IX statutory context that it came out of. The case is pretty clear. It turns on the specific text of Title VII. And the case also, Bostock, the majority opinion talks about how it's expressly not deciding other issues before it other than the Title VII decision. And it doesn't talk about, it's not going to prejudge how broadly its holding in that case will sweep. Comparing Title VII and Bostock and Title IX, which is in the new rules, you see that the latter, as I mentioned, expressly does allow for different treatment based on biological sex in certain circumstances. As I said, there's a living quarters exception, statutory exception. That's in section 1687 of Title IX. And in the 75 years after Title IX was enacted, the Department of Education itself and the courts all interpreted it to allow for instance, differential treatment between the sexes based on privacy concerns or safety concerns or that kind of thing. And the new rules run counter to all of that. Another important difference, I think, between Title IX and Title VII that would make Bostock an opposite is that Title IX was enacted pursuant to Congress's authority under the Spending Clause in Article I, Section 8 of the Constitution. Title VII was enacted under the Commerce Clause authority, which is broader and more plenary than the Spending Clause authority. Under the Spending Clause, federal funding that goes out pursuant to that clause, the Supreme Court has said, is analogous to a contractual arrangement between the federal government and states or other recipients of the federal funding. And part of that contractual arrangement, as a point of black letter contract law, is that you can't change the terms or conditions of this contractual arrangement after the deal's been entered into. The leading Supreme Court case on that is called Pennhurst, but that's just sort of black letter contract law as applied to the spending clause. The new rule would, in fact, change the terms and conditions of the original contract, the original deal that states and school districts entered into with the federal government by expanding the scope of sex, as well as some other changes we'll talk about. So that's another difference between this case and Bostock. There are, however, some superficial or textual similarities between Title IX and Title VII, and sometimes as a shortcut, courts have sort of construed them together. And it's not entirely clear what the Supreme Court will do if this case or another similar one goes up in front of it, whether the court will contain Bostock to the Title VII context, or whether, as the federal government argues for here and many other places, pursuant to President Biden's inaugural directive, that that Bostock applies many places outside of merely Title VII. As I said, Justice Gorsuch wrote Bostock. I mean, really kind of what we need is some clarification from him. Really, it's a moment of, you know, Justice Gorsuch, clean up in aisle three. We really need him to clean up and make clear what Bostock is intended to do and how far it's intended to sweep. I think it's clear from the face of the decision. It doesn't go beyond Title VII, but obviously the federal government and others think differently. We may get some guidance from a case coming up this fall. It's going to be argued before the Supreme Court in early December. It's called Scrimeti. It's a challenge under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to Tennessee's ban on gender treatment for minors. The government, federal government, also relies heavily there on Bostock. So what the Supreme Court will do with that case when it hears it, after it hears it in early December, may provide some guidance. Of course, the Equal Protection Clause, which is the claim the government is raising in Scrimeti, is much different from a Title IX issue, such as we have here in our case. So it may be easier to distinguish Bostock from Scrimeti and equal protection jurisprudence from what we have here. So Title IX could be a closer question, but as we'll talk about here, we'll see how that goes. The new Title IX regulations were set to take effect on August 1st, but as you may know, immediately after these regulations issued, roughly 10 separate lawsuits challenging them were filed in various federal courts by states, school districts, and parental rights groups. Specifically, cases were filed in the Western District of Louisiana, Eastern District of Kentucky, Northern District of Alabama, Kansas District Court, Eastern District of Missouri, and several cases were filed, of course, in the Northern District of Texas, where conservatives always go with good reason. There's been some consolidation of the cases. My firm, Defense of Freedom Institute, is co-counsel with the attorneys general of Louisiana, Mississippi, Montana, and Idaho, and the action was brought by those four states, along with 17 Louisiana school districts in the Western District of Louisiana. Ours was the first case filed in the country. We filed it early in the morning after the rule became effective. But there were a number of other cases filed that same day, April 29th. At this point, there's about 8 cases that have moved forward to motions for preliminary expedited relief. And the plaintiffs, including in our case, have been uniformly successful. So the new rule is now enjoined in most of the country, pending further proceeding. So this success may be an indication that Bostock and its construction of Title VII are in fact distinguishable from the present case and Title IX, but the Supreme Court, of course, will have the last word on all of this. Our complaint sets forth 5 causes of action. There's variations on our claims are found in the other cases, but largely the same claims appear in all the different complaints. First, the primary claim really is the rule is contrary to Section 706 of the APA, and the Department of Education lacks authority to promulgate it. That's really our primary claim. We have 2 more APA claims, namely that the rule is arbitrary and capricious, and that it was promulgated without observance of the notice and comment procedure required by the APA. We finally have 2 non-APA claims. One is based on, as I mentioned earlier, limits on Congress's spending clause authority, arguing, of course, as I said, the new rule improperly imposes new conditions on federal funding to schools. And the final claim is under Article I's vesting clause, namely that the determinations about what constitutes sex are now non-delegable, or at the least, if they are going to be delegated, they need to be done so with some intelligible principle to guide the agencies. And Title IX has no such intelligible principle regarding this issue of what sex means under the statute. There are 3 main substantive legal issues surrounding the new rule and that undergird our claims, and they're aimed at different parts of the new rules. The first target, I guess, of our claims is that Section 106.10 of the new rule. That's the one that reinterprets sex in Title IX. And we say that reinterpretation is contrary to the text and purpose of Title IX because the regulations expand the statute to include the prohibition on discrimination based on gender identity and concepts that go beyond biological sex, which was the originally publicly understood meaning of sex under the statute Title IX. Gender ID, identity, I should say, it is clearly a vague term. I mean, I'm doing a lot of litigation in this space these days, and the courts themselves are unclear about the terms. In fact, a 9th Circuit case, not regarding the specific issue, but a related transgender issue, it put a glossary at the beginning of its opinion because there's just not common understanding as to what some of these terms mean. And of course, in the law, you need precise definitions in order to be able to talk with one another, and I think that's unfortunately sorely lacking in this area. Hopefully that's something that the Scrimeti case and maybe others will help clarify. But in any event, the government itself doesn't try to define what sex is. It just says sex includes these things. It doesn't attempt to define what gender identity means. Instead, it just simply cites Bostock and says, look at Bostock, you know, enough said, which I don't think is sufficient. Also, regarding, relatedly and notoriously, under the new regs, section 106.31 says that sex-separated restrooms, showers, and locker rooms are now prohibited, which a lot of people have a lot of problem with. And that's gotten a lot of publicity, saying that you can't have separate bathrooms, et cetera, based on biological sex. This rule represents a sharp, abrupt departure from Title IX's text, as well as from 50 years of judicial and agency interpretation of the statute, as well as the agency's own enforcement practice in this area. The second main substantive legal issue relates to Section 106.2 of the new regulations, which imposes requirements on schools for addressing quote-unquote sex-based harassment. And those are contrary to law, the new requirements, we say. including the First Amendment rights of teachers, students, and others. Because under 106.2 of the new regulations, schools are required to police as well as to punish mispronouncing and other protected speech, because that can constitute sex-based harassment, according to the new rules. And these new the new rules as set forth in 106.2, they're contrary to non-First Amendment Supreme Court case law regarding schools' liability, a school's liability for harassment, sexual harassment under Title IX. There's a case called Davis from 1999, which was kind of the leading, or was the leading case in this area regarding what constitutes sexual harassment. And this new rule expands schools' exposure to liability, increases their obligations to police for offensive speech, and does so beyond what Davis had held in 1999. And the final kind of third target area, and somewhat relatedly, is that the new regs impose obligations on schools with regard to enforcement of Title IX that will violate the due process rights of those accused of discrimination, particularly in sexual harassment claims. For example, a single school employee can be the investigator, prosecutor, and judge in a discrimination grievance process, instead of those functions being divided among several individuals, which is what you do under common fundamental notions of due process. You don't have a single investigator, prosecutor, and judge, but these new rules would allow for that. So that's kind of the third area. After we filed our complaint, on the day that it was published, as I mentioned, April 29th, and by early May, we had filed a motion seeking preliminary relief and stay of the effective date, the August 1st effective date of the regulation. In our case, in the Western District of Louisiana, 16 blue states, led by California, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, filed an amicus brief in opposition to our motion. I think at this point, based on states that are plaintiffs and challenges the new Title IX, the new Title IX rules, as well as states that have opposed it in amicus briefs like the one I mentioned, filed by California, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and other blue states, I think at this point, like 42 of the 50 states have weighed in on the rules one way or the other. My own state, where I live, Wisconsin, has been sort of conspicuous by its absence, by its silence, I think. So there's a couple of states that haven't weighed in, pro or con, but they're the distinct minority of states. With regard to the preliminary injunction motion we filed on June 13th, that motion was granted by Judge Terry Doty, the Western District of Louisiana. Again, we got the first preliminary injunction motion granted of all these cases in the country, so that the entire rule is enjoined in the four states we represent, namely Louisiana, Mississippi, Montana, and Idaho. Between the grant of the preliminary injunction in our case on June 13th and then the end of this past July, additional preliminary injunctions were granted by federal courts in the Kansas, Eastern District of Kentucky, Northern District of Texas, and Eastern District of Missouri cases. In fact, preliminary injunctions were granted by every district court where a motion 4-1 was filed, except the Northern District of Alabama. However, there was an appeal the same day that the motion was denied, an appeal to the 11th Circuit. And that same day, the 11th Circuit promptly reversed the denial and put into place an injunction. So that was the only court that, district court at least, that denied the preliminary injunction, but it was quickly reversed literally that same day by the 11th Circuit. So far, none of the preliminary injunctions that have been granted have been nationwide injunctions. Relief has been limited to the plaintiffs in each of the cases. In total, at this point, I think there are 26 cases. There's 26 states which are covered by injunctions. Those are the 26 states that have appeared as plaintiffs challenging the new rule. In addition, organizations like Moms for Liberty and the Young Americas Foundation, they were plaintiffs in, I believe, the Alabama and Kansas actions. So the injunctions in those cases also covered numerous schools, I think thousands of schools, outside the 26 states. that are attended by children of members of Moms for Liberty or by members of the Young Americas Foundation. And that's creating a bit of a collateral controversy because schools in certain school districts, for instance, again, in Wisconsin, where I live, even though the state is not covered by an injunction in any of this litigation, there are schools that have children whose moms are in Moms for Liberty, and they're saying you can't enforce these Title IX regulations in those specific schools. And there's, as I said, some collateral administrative litigation going on about that currently. After this round of preliminary injunctions was granted, the government sought to partially stay them. In its stay motions, which were largely identical in each of the various courts, the Department of Education agreed to accept a preliminary injunction of Section 106.31A2, which, as I mentioned earlier, prohibits schools from preventing individuals from accessing certain sex-separated spaces like locker rooms and bathrooms consistent with their gender ID. So you can't prevent someone who identifies as a girl and biologically as a boy from going into the girl's bathroom, basically. But they agreed to accept that injunction. They also agreed to accept, as I mentioned, the 106.2 broad definition of hostile environment harassment, which, again, could be chilling free speech. However, the rest of the relief granted, the government sought to stay, including the redefinition, or again, as the government says, mere clarification of the scope of the term sex in 106.10. Besides 106.10, other provisions that the Department of Education wanted to enforce related to record keeping, discrimination reporting requirements, accommodations for pregnant students, and other things. The government's motions to stay the injunction, at least partially, were denied by the district courts. And the government then filed interlocutory appeals on denials, as well as on the merits of the preliminary injunction decisions. These partial stay appeals were rejected by the Fifth Circuit, Sixth Circuit, and I think it was the 11th Circuit in our case. The government then did appeal from denials of its application for stays in the Fifth and Sixth Circuits. The Supreme Court, the Fifth Circuit that it appealed from, was our case from Louisiana. And on August 16th, in a three-page per curiam decision, all members of the Supreme Court confirmed that the plaintiffs, Louisiana and all the other states, are entitled to the preliminary injunction relief as to the three provisions of the rule, the three central provisions of the rule that I've been talking about. Which portends well for an ultimate determination. All the Supreme Court said, it was making its decision, you know, in an emergency appeal posture based on a limited record. It also noted that because the Fifth and Sixth Circuits were expediting consideration of the appeals, that it looked forward or expected it would revisit or have this dispute return to it in the near future. In its decision, the court wrote that Section 106.10, which again defines sex discrimination to include discrimination on the basis of gender identity, it called it the central provision of the new regulation that they were allowing to be enjoined. So this could certainly be a preview about possible clarification of the court by the court in the future, either in this case or another case, about whether Bostock extends to Title IX, and obviously based on at least this preview, albeit on an expedited procedural posture as well as a limited record, it looks like the court is saying Bostock does not cover Title IX. But again, we'll see what develops. With regard to the scope of the preliminary injunctions beyond those three provisions of the rule that I mentioned, a five-justice majority found the injunctions were not overbroad and stated that, quote, there was not a sufficient basis to disturb the lower court's interim determination, or interim conclusions that the three provisions found likely to be unlawful are intertwined with and affect other provisions of the rule. In short, the court said the government failed to carry its burden of showing that three other provisions are independent of the main three enjoined. It was all inextricably intertwined, as they say, and the government had failed to show otherwise. There were four justices who found that the scope was too broad, that it shouldn't have enjoined the injunction shouldn't have covered the entire rule. Justice Gorsuch joined the three liberals in dissenting from that part of the decision. Justice Sotomayor wrote the dissent, and she said that the dissenters would stay the preliminary injunctions, except as to the three provisions at the heart of it, as we've been talking about, and they would do so in keeping with the traditional principle of equitable remedies, which is that the relief afforded to plaintiffs must not be more burdensome than necessary to redress the complaining parties. So again, they thought going beyond just the three central provisions was too broad and contrary to traditional principles of equitable remedies. As I understand it, sort of the three liberals presumably are not as sympathetic towards the rule generally, so maybe that's why they wanted to contain it. Justice Gorsuch, as he often does, he's got his own thing going on here. I guess this is a hobby horse of his. He likes to keep injunctions narrow, which is not necessarily a bad thing, except for in this case, I disagree with his thinking. But as a general matter, he doesn't like equitable relief, which is, of course, extraordinary relief, to go beyond what it really has to do in order to provide the preliminary preservation of the status quo. So, but nonetheless, the state of the law is that the rule is enjoined in all the 26 states in full currently. As of today, there are merits appeals on the preliminary injunction decisions that are currently pending in the 5th, 6th, 8th, 10th, and 11th circuits. Oral argument is scheduled for actually tomorrow, October 30th, in the 6th circuit case. So if you're able to listen in online, that'll be going on tomorrow at, I believe, 9 a.m. Eastern. In our case, the oral argument is going to be heard on November 4th, the day before the election, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I believe the 11th Circuit recently scheduled oral argument, the case before it, for December 18th. As I mentioned, there were several cases filed, I think at least two, in the Northern District of Texas, and appeals by the government from those decisions have been stayed pending our appeal, disposition of our appeal before the 5th. So the Northern District, the prosecutors in Texas, or the U.S. attorneys in Texas have said decided to allow our case to go forward first, I think. And they'll just sort of see what happens with regard to our case. Meanwhile, back down at the district courts, there's not been completely inactive or dormant down there. On September 20th, as it's pursuant to its discovery obligations, the Department of Education produced an administrative record that underlied or supported its promulgation of the new rules, which had been agreed to by the parties in all the cases. The government had said by September 20th, we'll give all of you plaintiffs our administrative record. So they did that. The administrative record constitutes about, I think it's 340,000 pages that need to be reviewed. So that may be the next step for many of us. In our case in Louisiana, there's been no scheduling order for dispositive motions or anything like that. Discovery and proceedings are on hold pending completion of the interlocutory appeal before the Fifth Circuit. However, that's not true for all the cases. I know that in the Northern District of Kentucky case, the parties, that is the government and the states, have filed cross motions for summary judgment. They were fully briefed by mid-September. So who knows, you might even get a summary judgment decision from the Northern District of Kentucky before you get the Sixth Circuit decision on the same case. But we'll see how all that develops. And finally, of course, to sort of wind down as a practical matter, Of course, the November 5th presidential election may almost certainly will determine much of what happens to this rule, the new rule, as well as the litigation generally. Presumably, everything may quickly become moot if President Trump wins on November 5th, although we'll have to wait and see how that unfolds. So that concludes my overview of the cases. I appreciate your attention. I'd like to thank you for your time, and I'll open it up now to questions or comments.
Great. Well, thank you. I actually want to touch on your last point, which you just mentioned, which is, you know, how would an upcoming administration affect Title IX and kind of interpretation. And so I was wondering if you could kind of explain a little bit more how, you know, if this is a Harris administration, how the interpretation might look versus a Trump interpretation, and your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a stark contrast. I think if Harris win, they're going to, this whole trans agenda that has been pushed, and again, this is in the Title IX context, but it's being pushed across the federal government, it's still going to go forward. It's very important, and I think it's politically very unpopular, but there's a constituency that's demanding it of the Democrats, and I think President Harris would push it forward. I see no sign of it abating. But also, again, we've had success in the courts thus far challenging it, and hopefully that would continue regardless of what kind of permutations of Bostock or what have you they put forward. With regard to the Trump administration, I mean, again, you can just watch former President Trump's commercials. It's pretty clear he's not into this, very much against it. So I think he would shut it down as quickly as possible. There could be some internal resistance in the bureaucracy, the swamp, as he says, but I don't think that would last long. So we'll see. And again, I don't know what the Biden administration would try to do between now and when he's actually finally no longer in office in January, if they would try to do something to push it forward. We'll just have to wait and see.
Helpful. Great. And so turning to an audience member question, and this is just a reminder to our audience that you can submit questions through the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen. But someone asks, what is the government's defense to the spending clause argument?
I think they basically say that it's not really a change. I mean, the spending clause jurisprudence isn't as clear. I've given you kind of, you know, I won't say one-sided, but I've given you kind of, you know, what I think the spending clause holds. But, you know, there is a lot of discretion. There are a lot of cases that the Supreme Court has said that spending clause conditions are pretty broad, and the government gets a lot of wiggle room as far as the strings it attaches to the funds it distributes. Sebelius, a big part of the Sebelius case, I think, cut back on that. It said that the amount of spending or amount of money received through the Medicaid program was so enormous that forcing states to accept, I don't know if it was the individual mandate or whatever part of the Obamacare that was being foisted on them under the spending clause, that it was basically coercing them to, they didn't really have a choice. It's, you know, an offer they couldn't refuse, and Vito Corleone kind of terms. And a lot of that we're saying as well is that in the past, it may be that the federal government has been given a leeway in order to impose or modify, clarify conditions. Again, the government is saying in our case, we're not changing the definition of sex, we're just clarifying it. So I don't think that's true. And I do think that at least, you know, somewhat, you know, in more recent jurisprudence, this whole notion of attaching strings to federal funding after the funding has gone out the door, there's been a settled practice for many years, it may amount to coercion. I mean, the test is there has to be a clear statement of what the provision says. We don't think there was a clear statement of what the recipients were getting into when they accepted these federal funds. Nobody knew that sex meant anything other than biological sex. So there may be some changes. The trend may be more towards requiring a clarification or, you know, real set conditions by the federal government on the front end, more so than perhaps past cases have allowed for. So I'm just saying the trend may be good for us in short. I think it is.
Great. And someone else asks, could Trump not only repeal the new rule, but change the federal government's litigation position in the current cases?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, most certainly. I think, you know, I mean, there was this notion in the past about, you know, defending the law and everything like that, regardless of sort of who it came from. But here, of course, the law was enacted by Congress. So we just talk about defending regulations. But those regulations, I think, again, you know, we've won in every court we've been in so far, at least on a preliminary basis. So I think Trump would do whatever he could. I think he would tell, in no uncertain terms, his DOJ to drop this. So the exact, and I'm not a DC guy, so I don't necessarily know the exact mechanics for doing that. But, and I don't think President Trump knows those procedural niceties either, but he would just say, drop this. Let's get out of the trans business and stop pushing this agenda because we're losing. And obviously he doesn't believe in it. And I think that most of the American people have real problems with it.
Helpful. So thoughts on how Loper-Bright and its possible implications for our deference might implicate the guidance documents from the Office of Civil Rights regarding women's sports on schools, if at all?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a good question. And obviously Loper-Bright, I mean, it came out after we had filed our claim, I think our case back in April, but we certainly kind of thought things looked good. And I think I know that in some of our appellate briefing, we referred to it, I believe. So to the extent, but again, the issue there is the government's not saying that sex is ambiguous or unclear. They get to step into the breach and define it. They're saying they're not defining it. They're saying we're just clarifying it. And so, I mean, I think Loper-Bright, general proposition of Loper-Bright, Jarkissi, Corner Post, all the cases that came down last term that pushed back on the administrative state, I think all those just give a general sentiment that's helpful, namely that bureaucracies can't do what they want. That at least general sentiment will play well in this. But again, no one's saying, I think if I recall, the government is saying this is not ambiguous. Sex isn't ambiguous. And we're just clarifying what it means, not redefining it.
Great. Another question. Someone says, instead of withdrawing the cases, could a potential Trump DOJ instead enter into helpful consent decrees with the plaintiffs that would bind future DOJs, hinting that kind of maybe past administrations have done this in various ways?
Yeah, the whole sue and settle strategy where, you know, an environmental rights group sues the government, you know, a friendly EPA, and then the friendly EPA enters into a friendly settlement agreement, you know, to bind future EPAs and future federal governments. That sue and settle strategy, I think, is something that, you know, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. I would imagine there'd be some effort at that here. I don't know whether just dismissing everything outright and throwing it is the better way of doing it. Again, getting back to Loper-Bright, I think there'll be less room going forward for agencies to inject their policy spin on statutory terms. Hopefully Congress will actually start doing something. And they'll enact statutes that do that to the extent there's public support for it. But the sue and settle model, you know, again, it's something that certainly the left has done, and then the right shouldn't be afraid if it makes sense.
Great. Someone wants to know, have any of the decisions thus far in these cases been penned by judge or justices that some might kind of consider more on the progressive wing?
Well, I mean, you know, the Supreme Court case, Sotomayor, Brown Jackson and Kagan, they all said that the preliminary injunction was appropriate. Sort of 106.10, the redefinition of sex and sexual harassment and sex separated spaces. So they've all said that. I think that's kind of, you know, the main thing. Otherwise, I don't know. I forget who the judges are. I mean, generally, you know, the suits were brought in jurisdictions that might be more friendly to the arguments the states were making. So many of the judges, if not most, are of that persuasion. But at the highest level, again, you've got the three of the classic liberals on the Supreme Court joining into this unanimous decision, upholding preliminary injunction as to the three kind of primary parts of the new rule.
Great. And unless there are any other questions, for parents that are potentially looking to get involved somehow, you know, with kids at schools and potentially being kind of concerned as some of these kind of Title IX cases move through, you know, how would you recommend parents to kind of be get involved in some of this?
Well, what I think, as I mentioned earlier, you know, Moms for Liberty and Young Americans for Freedom, they were litigants. And I think, you know, again, I know in Wisconsin, there's been some dispute as to children of members of Mom for Liberty are saying in certain school districts in Wisconsin, or at least in the schools, maybe not across the district, but that you can't do that because a judge in one of these cases said you can't do that because my kid is at the school. And I think people are, I believe I've heard that people are actually joining Moms for Liberty and I guess maybe Young Americans for Freedom in order to be able to make the same argument in the schools that their children attend. So that's something immediately you can do. Again, it's school districts and schools are going to fight back and the left is going to come in and say you can't do that. And it's sort of murky right now, but that's going on. Again, I know in my state, and again, my understanding is that people are joining these two groups so that it'll apply to their children's schools, namely these Title IX regs can't be enforced there.
Great. Well, Don, thank you so much. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you for the benefit of your time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars.
And I would say, if anybody has additional questions we couldn't get to, feel free to track me down. My information should be available. So feel free to track me down with any questions or comments you may have. And again, I appreciate Federalist Society hosting me and I appreciate you all listening to me.
Great. Well, thanks for that very generous offer. Well, thank you all so much for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.